ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in the Middle East pushing President Trump's plan to empty Gaza of Palestinians and take it over. But will the plan be welcomed by Arab allies? More ahead on Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump was sworn into office 4 weeks ago today, and quite a lot has happened. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. We take a look at his first month in office, which has many of his supporters cheering him on and his opponents asking whether what he's doing is legal. Also, I speak to the father of one of the hostages released by Hamas this weekend as part of the ongoing ceasefire deal. And author Yoni Applebaum says in his new book that Americans have lost their mobility, the thing that once made the U.S. distinctive. It's Monday, February 17th. Singer-songwriter Ed Sheeran is 34 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on its bid to fire the head of the federal government's office for whistleblowers. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports the case sets up a test of the president's executive power.
President Trump moved to fire the head of the Office of Special Counsel Hampton Dellinger earlier this month, but a federal judge blocked the move, at least for now. In the court filing, the Trump administration calls the case an unprecedented assault on the separation of powers. The Trump administration claims the president has the power to remove government officers, and the delay hurts his ability to manage the executive branch. Federal law says the special counsel may be removed by the president only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. None of those concerns were cited in an email dismissing Dellinger. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The union representing some workers at the Federal Aviation Administration says hundreds of FAA workers are getting fired. The union chief says the Trump administration started sending termination letters to probationary employees Friday night. There are strong concerns the FAA is already short on workers who handle safety, especially air traffic controllers. This comes after last month's deadly air crash in Washington that killed 67 people. High-level U.S. and Russian delegations will gather in Saudi Arabia this week. Their talks are expected to focus on restoring U.S.-Russian relations and finding an end to the war in Ukraine. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio will lead the U.S. delegation, with White House envoy Steve Witkoff and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz also joining. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov heads the Russian mission with the Kremlin, saying talks will focus on making peace, not war. Yet speaking in Moscow, Lavrov rejected in advance the notion of returning any land annexed by Russia to Ukraine. His comments may be the latest sign that U.S. negotiators are boxed in before the talks even begin. Following a phone call between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin last week, Trump appeared to argue a lasting peace required Ukraine ending its NATO ambitions and relinquishing territory to Moscow, two key Russian demands. Charles Maines, NPR News.
Potent storms slammed the south over the weekend, killing at least a dozen people. One person died in Georgia. At least 11 more have been killed in Kentucky following flash flooding, damaging winds, and intense thunderstorms. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear says some areas got up to 6 inches of rain.
All of Kentucky still has standing water in different areas. Over 300 roads still impacted and closed.
The governor says five counties in Kentucky have set records for daily rainfall. The National Weather Service has issued extreme cold warnings for the Central Plains this morning. Temperatures feel well below zero from the Canadian border to parts of Oklahoma. You're listening to NPR. Officials in India say at least 18 people have died after a stampede at a railway station in New Delhi. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai. This happened as thousands of people were waiting to board a train.
The New Delhi caretaker chief minister said on X that many victims were Hindu pilgrims who were heading to the Mahakumbh festival in India's north. The festival lasts for 6 weeks and gathers tens of millions of worshippers. This stampede comes after more than 30 people died at the Kumbh Mela last month in another stampede. Critics of the Hindu nationalist BJP, which rules both the federal government and the state where the festival takes place, say not enough has been done to accommodate the crowds of pilgrims. Prime Minister Narendra Modi said on X that he was distressed by the stampede. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
Rebels in Eastern Democratic of the Republic of the Congo have captured the second largest city in DRC. The city is Bukavu, and it's home to about 1 million people. The rebels are backed by neighboring Rwanda. They've captured the city of Goma, and the Rwandan-backed rebels say they plan to march on the Congolese capital. The Vatican says Pope Francis will need to remain hospitalized. He was admitted to a Rome hospital last Friday for the treatment of bronchitis. The situation was growing worse. The Vatican now says the pontiff's respiratory tract infection is presenting a complex clinical picture for doctors. They say that the Pope, however, has rested quietly overnight. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, Kentucky is under a federal emergency after the state was pummeled with rain and snow over the weekend. We'll bring you the latest on the flooding. But first,
Marco Rubio is in the Middle East, and his first stop as Secretary of State in the region was Israel. Here's what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had to say about their meeting.
We talked about how do we complete the change in the Middle East.
Change in the Middle East. Rubio today is in Saudi Arabia, where he will be discussing President Trump's plan to turn Gaza into a seaside real estate development and displace all the Palestinians. He'll also meet a Russian delegation about ending the war in Ukraine.
Let's bring in NPR international correspondent Eya Batraoui in Dubai. So first, walk us through Secretary Rubio's discussions in Israel.
Hey, good morning, A. So his main message is pushing Trump's plan for Gaza and ensuring the ceasefire there holds long enough to release all Israeli hostages held there by Hamas. And he made clear the U.S.-Israeli alliance has never been stronger, particularly under Trump, of course. Now, he arrived in Israel the day after another exchange of Israeli hostages and Palestinian detainees took place and prisoners. And this ceasefire deal, it expires in 2 weeks, all right? So Trump officials are saying now that there will be a second phase of this deal to bring home more hostages. So while Rubio's visit is to see all of this through on the Israeli side, he's also in the region to reinforce Trump's plan after the ceasefire to rebuild Gaza under U.S. ownership and permanently displace Palestinians outside. And after meeting Netanyahu in Israel yesterday, Rubio doubled down on the plan.
It may have shocked and surprised many, but what cannot continue is the same cycle where we repeat over and over again and wind up in the exact same place.
So displacing Palestinians outside Gaza was an idea relegated to the far right in Israel until recently. I mean, now has the backing of Israel's prime minister. Tell us what's he saying?
Well, Netanyahu's called Trump's vision for Gaza revolutionary and says it did not come as a surprise because they'd spoken about it before it was announced by Trump earlier this month. And while addressing the conference of major American Jewish organizations yesterday in Israel, Netanyahu said Gaza has been described as the biggest open-air prison, but that people there now should have the choice to leave. And he said this.
The possibilities that loom today before us have never been before us before, have never been available to us as they are now. And we intend to pursue them to the full.
So the thing is, I mean, the plan for Gaza will need Arab buy-in, especially from the wealthy Arab Gulf states. Tell us what Secretary Rubio might be hearing when he talks to leaders in Saudi Arabia for the UAE meeting today and tomorrow.
Well, today actually marks 500 days of this war since the deadly October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel in 2023. And public sentiment here in the region has turned even harder on Israel. And that's because of the tens of thousands of Palestinians killed by Israeli airstrikes in Gaza since. Now, Saudi Arabia's crown prince was close to establishing ties with Israel 2 years ago, but he has since described Israel's war in Gaza as a genocide. And so there's really no indication that ties with Israel and Saudi Arabia are on the horizon, at least for the moment. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries rely on U.S. military support, and they have business ties with Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner, but they also have an oil pact and business ties with Russia. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are also positioning themselves as brokers between the U.S. and Russia. Now, you know, Rubio is leading a team of White House officials today to Saudi Arabia, where he will meet with Kremlin officials during their time there to discuss ending the war in Ukraine. Now, these talks are ahead of what could be a Trump-Putin summit in Saudi Arabia. Ukraine says they're not part of the talks today, but Ukraine's president is in the UAE right now, and he's expected to head next to Saudi Arabia.
All right, that's Haya Batraoui in Dubai. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
The entire state of Kentucky is under a federal emergency. Hard rains pummeled the state Saturday and then brought snow on Sunday. So far, 9 people are confirmed dead. Governor Andy Beshear has said there have been more than 1,000 water rescues. Kentucky Public Radio's Justin Hicks has been reporting on the flooding from Louisville and joins us now. Hi, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Layla.
Good morning. So no part of the state was spared by this latest storm. Can you tell us about some of the places that were hit hardest?
Yeah, that's correct. So statistically, western Kentucky got the most rain. It's relatively flat. It got about 7 inches of rain in just about a day, which is a ton. It does seem like the most lasting damage, though, is going to be in eastern Kentucky, the more mountainous region, and that's probably where people are seeing most of these photos from. And meteorologists say the impact is just because of the topography. Western Kentucky has these big rivers like the Green River. They can swell, but they're slower moving. But in the Appalachian Mountains, flash floods can come from water racing down those mountains. They happen really suddenly, and they can be really hard to anticipate. And so that's what we're dealing with. It's also worth noting there's a lot of mountainous counties in West Virginia and Tennessee that are also dealing with flooding, too.
Now, eastern Kentucky also experienced severe flooding back in July 2022. How does this compare to that?
Yes, I've been told there's some key differences. One emergency manager told me he seems like there's less damages to houses, but more damage to roads and bridges this time around.
Okay.
But also compared to 22, people are just more prepared. Officials and meteorologists made sure to give lots of warnings. And also most of this rain came during the day, so people weren't caught off guard or asleep like they were back then. I talked to Gigi Neese in a little town called Busy, Kentucky. And she's actually survived both of these floods. In 22, she lost her home to a mudslide, and then she moved to a totally different place, built her house on a 10-foot-high foundation, and she thought that would be enough. But then Saturday, the water rose so much, she had to call 911 and be rescued by a boat.
I know how that water runs. I know how it flows, you know, because I've seen it all of my life. So that's why when we built where we did, I knew there was a potential for flooding, but not like this.
So what do the next few days look like for Kentucky?
Yeah, so the rivers are really high still, and in some cases they're actually still cresting as the water is gushing from all those tiny streams towards the Ohio River, our main river here on the border of the state. And then meanwhile, people just jumped into action helping their friends and family. For most of them, this is not their first disaster. I mean, they know the drill. You clean up the debris and you document everything for insurance and FEMA claims. And then meanwhile, search and rescue teams are still out for a few days, probably. Emergency managers are also trying to clear the roads of debris, mudslides, rock slides, and just trying to get to folks who are stuck up in hollers. They also need to restore drinking water and get those backed up sewer systems running again. Of course, those things could take some time. The big thing we're watching here in Northern Kentucky is a snowstorm. That's actually expected to hit us in a few days, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. That's supposed to leave somewhere between 2 to 8 inches of snow, and that's going to complicate things. And already temperatures have dropped a lot, and is supposed to stay below freezing for the rest of the week.
Okay, Justin, stay warm, stay inside.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Justin Hicks with Kentucky Public Radio.
President Trump was sworn into office 4 weeks ago today.
And in those 4 weeks, he has gotten the Senate to confirm even his most controversial cabinet picks. His executive actions have forced dramatic changes in the federal government, and he's even tried to eliminate entire agencies. The courts have put a pause on some actions where there are very real questions about whether what Trump wants to do is legal or even constitutional.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has been following all of this. Tam, so over the weekend, Donald Trump posted on social media, quote, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." What do you make of that?
Well, this is one of the biggest themes of the second Trump term. President Trump is taking a very expansive view of his executive authority. He is blowing past statutes like the law requiring 30 days notice to Congress before firing inspectors general and running straight into significant constitutional questions. He's trying to redefine birthright citizenship, something enshrined in the Constitution. He's freezing federal funds and trying to erase agencies that were created by Congress without going back to Congress for the authority to do it. And I should say he's trying to do much more, much faster, and going it alone in a way that he didn't in his first term. But he has a lot less to lose this time. He isn't running for re-election, and the Supreme Court has given presidents broad legal immunity for laws that are broken in the course of doing their jobs.
Sure, but what happens if courts do decide to step in and decide what the president is trying to do is maybe illegal or unconstitutional?
We're likely going to find out, and perhaps sooner than later. President Trump did say last week that he will abide by the courts. But already, in at least one case, a federal judge has found that the Trump administration defied a temporary order to unfreeze federal funding. The administration has appealed. If a theme of the first Trump administration was that he was challenging norms, the theme this time around is that he is challenging laws and the common understanding of the balance of power laid out in the Constitution. Yesterday, he shared an article on social media that argued the real threat to democracy is Democrats and federal judges trampling on the president's authority.
So, okay, in terms of foreign affairs now, what is the message that the Trump administration is sending to the world so far?
There's a new sheriff in town, and he is nothing like Joe Biden. Biden was all about strengthening alliances. Trump is coming at it from a very different perspective. He is skeptical of international organizations like NATO and doesn't think alliances are worth much unless they are directly helping the U.S. This week, we're expecting that meeting in Saudi Arabia with Russian officials and U.S. diplomats to discuss the end of the war in Ukraine. At this point, Europe isn't at the table, and it's not clear just yet what Ukraine's role will be. Add to this Trump's many tariff threats, the latest being reciprocal tariffs on friends and rivals alike, his talk of wanting to take back the Panama Canal or Greenland or even take control of Gaza. I think it's safe to say the era of predictability in American foreign policy is over.
Seems so, yeah. So how is all this playing with his supporters?
Well, generally speaking, his supporters are cheering him on all the way, and Democrats are beside themselves. But if you paid attention to what he said on the campaign trail, none of what's happened in this first month should be much of a surprise. It's just a lot of people didn't believe he was going to do all these things, or certainly not all at once.
That's Tamara Keith. Tam, thanks.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we devote President's Day to understanding the scope of President Donald Trump's power as he continues to potentially break laws, use billionaire Elon Musk to dismantle the government, and circumvent Congress. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses, from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The writer Yoni Applebaum has an item on the wall of his house.
What are we looking at here?
This is an ad from an old Sears catalog.
From an era when the Sears department store chain advertised prefabricated homes.
You could buy the Sears Puritan Colonial. And what I really love about this ad is the price. It cost $1,947, which is just slightly less than I ended up paying.
A few generations later, it was slightly more expensive.
Quite a bit more expensive, really, though this Sears house is still small and simple. Applebaum says the first buyer ordered it 100 years ago.
It arrived like a giant Lego set, a lot of pieces and a book of instructions.
A high school teacher assembled this house for his family with his own hands at a time when housing was cheap and Americans moved a lot for new opportunities. Today, housing is not cheap, not even this old Sears house.
There is nobody living off the salary of a high school teacher who's buying into this neighborhood today.
It's in a prosperous city, Washington, D.C., where housing costs have soared. Today, many Americans can't afford to move where the jobs are. Applebaum traces this change in a book called Stuck, a one-word title that tells you what the author thinks of our loss of mobility.
The thing that once made America distinctive, the thing that when people came over here from Europe, they noticed right away, was that Americans tended to move a lot. In the 19th century, maybe one out of three Americans moved every year.
One out of three?
It was an astonishing festival of mobility. There would be a moving day in each city where a third, half the city would pick up and swap houses in a single afternoon. All the leases ran out at the same time, and everybody was hoping to move up and find something a little bit better. As late as 1970, it was one out of five Americans moving each year. And we just got new numbers from the census. We have set a new record. It was only one in 13.
Housing costs have gone up way more than salaries have. It's especially bad in areas with lots of jobs, which means that many Americans miss out on opportunities. That's what he means by stuck. What's driving up home prices in a city that's prosperous like the one we're sitting in now?
We're sitting right now in a neighborhood of single-family homes. If you wanted to take one of these houses and turn it into an apartment building, you couldn't do that. 100 years ago, America adopted zoning ordinances, which restricted what people could build on their land.
Zoning governed how much of a property could be covered by a house, or how many units could be on it, or how high the building could be, all of which affected housing density.
There's always a reason not to build denser housing. People worry about parking. They worry about shadows. They worry about the changing nature of the community or its historic character. These are all actual concerns, and they're legitimate concerns.
The problem comes when residents use those concerns to keep far too many neighborhoods exactly as they are.
If you block almost all new developments, it gets impossible for Americans to move toward opportunity.
You can buy a cheap house in a town that doesn't have too many jobs. Applebaum's area has plenty of jobs and not enough homes. He says his own neighborhood prides itself on racial diversity, welcoming all kinds of people, so long as they are all able to pay in the high six figures for a single family home.
Not far from where I live, there's a metro station with a large parking lot that's largely unused. And 25 years ago, there was a proposal to build housing on that parking lot. It's exactly the sort of project that urban planners will tell you they love. You put people living next to mass transit, next to a downtown area. They don't need to use cars a whole lot, and you can build on vacant land, so you're not displacing anyone. This project had everything going for it. 25 years later, you can drive by and still see the parking lot. It's finally moving toward construction, but it has been held up by legal challenges and public hearings and process delays for a quarter century. And that's an ideal development, with almost no reasonable objections to its construction. It gets even harder in more complicated cases.
What are the politics of that area that has resisted that change so long?
This is one of the most progressive communities in America, and it's not alone. There was a fascinating study of California which found that for every 10 points better that liberal candidates did in those cities, housing permits in those cities dropped by 30%. Progressives have overwhelmingly been the ones to have layered on these rules and walled off the communities that they celebrate for their diversity, for their openness, from allowing new people to move into those communities.
People have so many theories about why Americans are so angry and so divided, and feel the country is not working for them. Do you feel you've hit on the actual reason that that is?
We know a lot about what happens when people want to move and they can't. Psychologists tell us they grow more cynical, more disconnected. Sociologists tell us that they're less likely to become active members of groups and organizations, less likely to show up in church on Sunday. Economists tell us that their earnings will stagnate. They won't move into new careers. They'll have fewer jobs and start fewer businesses. We can see all of these things happening. Americans have watched their country change over the last 50 years. There's a broad sense in this country that something is broken, that it doesn't work the way that it used to. And we can also talk to the political scientists who will tell us that people who moved more than 100 miles from their hometown were likely to vote for Democrats in recent presidential elections, and those who remain very close to their birthplace were much likelier to vote for President Donald Trump. The chance to shape your own life, to have agency, to choose where you want to live, leads people to feel hopeful about the future, to feel open to the possibility that others' gains might lift everybody up, and that people who feel stuck in place, conversely, tend to see the world as a zero-sum game in which the gains that anyone's making come at their expense.
Yoni Applebaum, author of Stuck, says he's found one way to think about America's divide. Some people can afford to take advantage of this country's economy, and some people can't. This is NPR News.
Some New Yorkers are angry that Mayor Eric Adams has agreed to work with the Trump administration to crack down on illegal immigration.
The people who pay taxes in his city, the people who are up at 4 a.m. driving deliveries, those are the people who are being served up on a silver platter for President Trump.
I'm Elsa Chang. Is New York still a city that embraces immigrants? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston.
High-level American and Russian delegations are gathering in Saudi Arabia this week for talks aimed at ending the war in Ukraine. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports European leaders are meeting in Paris after not being invited to those negotiations.
Europeans knew the Trump administration was going to be a rougher ride than the Biden administration, but they still held out hope that the U.S. and Europe could work together, especially on ending the war in Ukraine. But that illusion burst this week. First, there was U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's visit to NATO. He basically told European allies the U.S. has bigger priorities in Asia and Europe needs to take care of itself.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reporting from Paris. Protesters in New York City are calling on Mayor Eric Adams to step down. The demonstrations came days after the Justice Department pushed to drop a corruption case against him. Adams is resisting calls for his resignation. He spoke to congregants at two churches in Queens over the weekend.
They want to fight me. I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to stay consistent on my mission.
New York City is set to hold its mayoral primary in June. Adams is facing multiple challenges in his reelection bid. This is NPR. Authorities in South Korea have suspended downloads of a Chinese artificial intelligence app. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports the app, known as DeepSeek, caused a global tech stock sell-off last month by offering AI functions at a fraction of its rivals.
South Korea's privacy watchdog, the Personal Information Protection Commission, said the DeepSeek app downloads were suspended Saturday. They'll remain that way until DeepSeek brings its app into line with South Korea's data privacy laws. DeepSeek says it'll cooperate with the commission. The watchdog told users who have already downloaded the app to use it with caution due to concerns about how users' data is managed. Australia and Taiwan have banned DeepSeek from government devices. The U.S. Congress is considering a similar bill. China's foreign ministry says it respects local privacy laws, but opposes politicizing tech issues. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Pope Francis remains hospitalized. He was admitted last week to undergo treatment for bronchitis. The Vatican says the 88-year-old pontiff's respiratory tract infection is presenting a complex clinical picture for doctors. A spokesman for the Vatican says the Pope seems to be in good spirits, was able to eat breakfast this morning, and had a restful night. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Sagi Dekelkhan has finally been reunited with his family. The 36-year-old dual U.S. and Israeli citizen is one of the three hostages Hamas released from captivity in Gaza over the weekend. The release is part of a ceasefire deal with Israel that also saw 369 Palestinian prisoners and detainees freed by Israel. Sagi's father, Jonathan Dekelkhan, joins me now. Thank you for being here, Jonathan.
Good morning.
What was that first moment like, the moment you saw Sagi again for the first time in nearly 500 days?
Well, it was a feeling that I was a witness to a miracle, quite honestly. That was the sensation, you know, before I was really close enough to him to really take it all in. And once I was, I knew that it was my son. That Sagi himself had come home. Sagi, he speaks with his eyes, and once I saw his eyes, I knew that somehow, he had survived in 500 days in hell, and my son was back with us.
How is Sagi physically and emotionally?
Well, we knew in advance that by the forensic evidence in their home that he had been wounded during the massacre, Hamas's massacre on Kibbutz Nir Oz on October 7th.
Yeah.
Those wounds now will need extensive treatment in order to rehabilitate him. And as you might imagine, 500 days of abuse and malnutrition and lack of health care and sanitation in a tunnel without seeing the light of day for all of that time has cast a heavy toll on Sagi's body. But it is all fixable, and that's what's most important. He's in remarkably good spirits under the circumstances. We have no doubt that there will be, you know, some ups and downs over the next days, weeks, months, because, of course, 500 days not knowing in any given second whether you're going to live or die at the hands of murderous terrorists, of course, has an effect on anyone.
The last time we spoke, you told us one of Sagi's children was born while he was a hostage in Gaza, that he had never met his child. What was it like for him to finally meet that child and be reunited with his other children?
Well, I think there's something we need to know even before answering that question. It turns out that Sagi, and we now know almost all of the hostages held underground in the tunnels, knew nothing of the outside world. So from October 7, 2024, 23, I'm sorry, Sagi had no idea if his wife and children or any of us had survived the massacre. He only learned, and not directly, but sort of indirectly, he's pieced together some bits of information 2 days before his release that his wife had survived, and that at least his two little girls had also survived. So that really, until he crossed the border into Israel, he was not really aware of the fact that any of them were alive or that his daughter had been born. So, of course, all of this news was he was beyond joy. I don't think there are words in Hebrew or in English or any other language to really describe the emotions, the feelings on both sides, both his and ours at this reunion, really coming back from the Valley of Death, or the Tunnels of Death, more exactly, in this case. He has met all of his girls, or reunited with his two older daughters, and met for the first time Shachar, who is now a year and 2 months old. She was born about 2 months after the massacre. And like I said, it's spectacular. It gives one faith, I suppose, that there are greater forces in the world at work. But there's much more to be done. There are still 73 Israeli hostages being held by Hamas in those same hellish tunnels. So we have much more work to do to bring everyone home.
That's Jonathan Dekelkhan, a professor of Jewish history at the Hebrew University. His son, Sagi, was held captive by Hamas for 16 months and is home again. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm so happy for your family.
Thank you for having me.
removing lead paint and pipes, cleaning up contaminated land, installing solar panels in low-income neighborhoods. Those are just some of the projects affected by the Trump administration's move to freeze funding that was approved by Congress. NPR's Michael Copley reports on some concerns that the government cannot be counted on to protect human health and the environment.
West Virginia is dotted with abandoned mines, and its water's been polluted by heavy industry. So when federal aid started arriving a couple years ago, it was a lifeline, says Autumn Crow. She's deputy director of a conservation group called West Virginia Rivers Coalition.
Communities were really excited about these opportunities.
That money's in jeopardy now because of a funding freeze ordered by the Trump administration. And it's Republican-led areas that have been some of the biggest beneficiaries of the infrastructure and climate change investments that Trump's targeting. Crow says the impacts in her state could be devastating.
These communities have been left behind and their infrastructure is failing. And without the federal government coming in to help support them, they're not going to be able to come up with that money on their own.
Trump's promised to slash federal spending. An official in the Trump administration didn't respond to a message seeking comment. Elise Campaign works at the Southern Environmental Law Center. She says threats from climate change will keep growing whether the administration tries to deal with them or not.
So to back out of any kind of leadership role and to defund programs that were specifically designed to address these needs just shifts the risk and the cost back onto communities and individuals.
Federal courts have ordered the administration to lift its funding freeze, but groups say some promised money has still been held back. Zahra Ahmed's vice president at Carbon Direct, which helps businesses, governments, and other organizations cut their carbon emissions. She says the funding freeze looks like a way of trying to shake people's trust in government aid.
I think people are going to be a lot more reluctant to do business with the federal government for fear of making investments, uprooting their lives, only to have the rug pulled out from under them by the federal government.
A federal judge said in a recent order that the Trump administration's funding freeze is likely unconstitutional. Michael Copley, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The couple behind the wildly popular YouTube channel Squirmy and Grubs talk about their relationship. One partner is disabled, the other isn't. Next time, Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today. Your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin with a story about chocolate cake saving a life. Recently, an Omaha woman went outside to retrieve the chocolate Costco cake she left on her patio, only to find an opossum lying and panting on top of her outdoor couch. Fearing chocolate poisoning, she called the Humane Society to take the cake bandit away. Nebraska Wildlife Rehab says the opossum is being treated for its dietary habits and an unrelated lead toxicity problem. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faudel.
And I'm A. Martinez. It's Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary season, and last night they celebrated with a live primetime special full of sketches and nostalgia. It kicked off with a monologue featuring Steve Martin, Martin Short, and former SNL writer John Mulaney, who offered some humor about working on the show with celebrity hosts.
As I look around, I see some of the most difficult people I have ever met in my entire life. Over the course of 50 years, 894 people have hosted Saturday Night Live, and it amazes me that only two of them have committed murder.
Canadian-born Short was eventually taken off stage by cast members dressed as ICE agents. And the primetime special stretched out over more than 3 hours, and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans was watching. He joins us now. So Eric started off with Sabrina Carpenter and Paul Simon, ended with Paul McCartney, and in between celebrity cameos from Jack Nicholson to Emma Stone. Sounds like fun, Eric. Was it?
Well, I think how you felt about this special probably depended on how seriously you take Saturday Night Live to begin with. I mean, if all you were expecting was this evening filled with nostalgia and comedy, seeing the return of cast members you once liked and sketches which once appeared on the show, then you probably enjoyed it. But if you were looking for something a little more substantive, you know, something that really put the last 50 years in perspective or surfaced some of those old sketches with a new spin geared to modern times, you might have come away a little disappointed, as I was. Still, there were a lot of high points in this program. Meryl Streep showed up for the first time as the mother to a character played by Kate McKinnon, who tells all these crazy stories about getting abducted by aliens. And Eddie Murphy scored points early on, playing former cast member Tracy Morgan in a revival of the Black Jeopardy sketch, while Morgan was standing next to him playing a different character. So let's listen to a clip where Murphy kind of brings up their resemblance.
James Earl Jones is my biological father. Mm-hmm. You know what? I think we might be related.
I don't see it.
And then Eddie Murphy showed up again in a reprisal of their Scared Straight sketch where he played an inmate with some hair issues alongside Will Ferrell and Kenan Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, it's 50 years for SNL. I mean, to like squeeze 50 years in 3 hours or so, I mean, mm-hmm. How did they talk about the history of the show?
Well, they tried to find all these different ways to kind of call back to the show's long history. I mean, besides reviving these classic sketches like Rachel Dratch's Debbie Downer or Maya Rudolph and Amy Poehler's Bronx Beat TV show, which Mike Myers crashed as his coffee talk character, Linda Richmond, they offered all these edited montages of different comedy moments over the years, including physical comedy and commercial parodies. And they even had an in memoriam for their sketches, which aged the worst, including jokes with ethnic stereotypes or sexual harassment and gay panic. It just showed how much comedy could change in 50 years.
Yeah. So, okay, what was notable to you? And was there anything that just absolutely did not work?
Well, I was surprised that more of the cast from the first season wasn't involved with the sketches. Lorraine Newman appeared in a pre-taped sketch, and Garrett Morris introduced a replay of a classic short film. But even though Chevy Chase and Jane Curtin were in the audience, they didn't appear in sketches. Dan Aykroyd didn't seem to be there at all. Some classic sketches like Wayne's World and Coneheads, they didn't reprise. I thought some sketches were great, but they played a bit too long. They did use musical bookends to speak to the show's generational reach, starting the show with that duet between Paul Simon and Sabrina Carpenter, and ending with a Beatles medley by Paul McCartney, which seemed to highlight the generation who started SNL and the generation that might take it into the future.
Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. Eric and I just talked amongst ourselves for the last 3 minutes. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Archaeologists in London have made a startling discovery in the very heart of the city, dating back to its earliest origins as a small town once known as Londinium. Philip Marks has more.
As developers prepared to pull down a 90-year-old building in London's financial district, they spotted something far older lurking at its basement. Contractors soon made way for archaeologists, who dug large trenches as they searched for remains of Roman London amid the capital city's centuries-old layers of construction.
In one trench, we hit a massive piece of masonry that's about 3 or 4 feet wide.
Sophie Jackson is Director of Developer Services at Museum of London Archaeology.
We extended the pit, and it was kept on going. So basically, we've got a huge piece of Roman wall, which represents part of the structure for the nave of this basilica, the central part of this town hall.
Jackson says such basilicas like amphitheatres, public baths and fortified walls were a crucial component of any sizable Roman settlement.
Really, it's the sort of heart of any significant Roman town. It's where the administrative centre, it's where the law courts are, it's where the magistrates sit, it's where all the big decisions are made. But it's also a place where merchants would come and do business.
The site has remained a commercial centre for London almost ever since, and historians say that makes the discovery even more surprising.
For something so important to the history of London to survive so much development over so many centuries is really remarkable.
Jane Siddell is the Principal Inspector for Ancient Monuments at Historic England, an agency that advises the government on matters of national heritage.
You can read all you like, you can watch Gladiator at the cinema, but when you actually physically come face to face with something that's been there for 1800 years, that connection with a nearly 2000-year-old legacy is amazing.
The Basilica was built in around 80 AD, at a time when London's population likely topped around 40,000. And its construction reflected the Romans' decision to double down on the city as the capital of the new province of Britain, says Sophie Jackson.
It was a really high building, and nobody would have seen anything like this before in Britain. And so it was designed to impress and perhaps intimidate the local population.
The developers of the new high-rise that will soon tower above the ruins aims to put these unusual findings on public display. The latest sign that London's changing skyline is more respectful than ever before of a past that's buried beneath it, even though it costs the construction firms involved a little more money. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks.
The idea of a broken heart is a familiar metaphor, but broken heart syndrome is a real condition that can land people in the emergency room. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, it can strike after a dramatic event or a stressful period in life.
If you've ever had a moment swimming in the ocean when a current starts to pull you, you know how terrifying that can be. That's what happened to Maria Caraballo while on vacation in Puerto Rico. She was with her two young grandsons who were struggling to swim.
We were being pulled into the ocean, you know. It was such desperation of, oh my God, we're going to die today.
As they pulled further away from the shore, she was holding on to the boys, trying to keep their heads above the water.
We started yelling, auxilio, ayúdanos, ayúdanos, help, help.
A swimmer nearby heard them and came to help.
I fell into the swimmer's arms and just thanked him so much.
She and her grandsons were out of danger, but in the hours that followed, she felt like she was having a heart attack.
I was heaving, like trying to catch my breath, and I kept doing that for quite a while, and that's what made me go to the hospital.
She felt like an elephant was sitting on her chest, but her diagnosis was not a heart attack. Turns out she had stress cardiomyopathy, also known as broken heart syndrome. I asked Dr. Joy Gelbman, a cardiologist at New York Presbyterian and Weill Cornell Medicine, if this is how it typically comes on.
Absolutely. I mean, she's kind of a classic case, you know, highly stressful scenario, a classic presentation of chest pain.
Dr. Gelbman treated Maria once she'd returned to New York. She says broken heart syndrome can be triggered by all kinds of stressful events, the death of a loved one or pet, a bad breakup, or a physical shock. And it can be tricky to diagnose because tests can make it seem like the person is having a heart attack. Blood tests show evidence of the same cardiac enzyme.
And the imaging, the echocardiogram, typically shows this characteristic ballooning of the heart muscle.
But here's the key difference. With a heart attack, doctors will find a blockage in the coronary arteries. Not so with broken heart syndrome.
One of the defining features of it is that there are actually no serious blockages of the heart arteries.
Instead, it's a temporary yet dramatic weakening of the heart muscle that seems to be caused by a sudden burst of stress hormones that flood the heart. Dr. Grant Reed is a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic.
The best understanding we have is that the heart reacts very strongly to an adrenaline surge, and that adrenaline surge causes the heart muscle to weaken in a certain way. It's almost like the heart is overworked for that period of time, and then it weakens.
Dr. Reed says he became fascinated by the condition when he and his colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic saw nearly a four-fold increase in broken heart syndrome during the stressful COVID lockdown period. It was a reminder of the inextricable link between the mind and the body.
Emotional stress can lead to a physical consequence. It's very important that we take care of ourselves, both physically and mentally. And broken heart syndrome is really a great example of the intersection between the two.
Dr. Sudeep Saha, a cardiologist at Kaiser Permanente, says many patients with broken heart syndrome are glad to learn that they did not have a heart attack.
Most people are relieved to hear that in almost virtually all cases, with time and with medicines, this can be reversed.
And it also underscores the benefits of managing anxiety and stress. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.